on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. We have a really fascinating show for you today. Two topics I know so little about. First up today, we're going to talk about film history as it related to the Manhattan Project and how that affects business today. It's a fascinating story with Alice Lovejoy. And then Ron Fry is with us. He is a very successful publisher. And if you're thinking about getting a book published, he is a great resource. He is part of our greatest hits series. For those of you who don't know, our server from old went out of business. And so they were like, you can buy the hard drives and stuff and come get them. But I didn't want to do that. So we lost a bunch of years of old files and shows and stuff like that. So we're bringing back the greatest hits. And this is one of them in the second hour of the show. We'll be right back to get started. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm really excited for my next guest. We're going to talk about something I know absolutely nothing about, and so I'm excited to learn. Please welcome Alice Lovejoy to the show. She is the award-winning author of Army Film in the Avant-Garde, Cinema and Experiment in the Czechoslovak Military. She is the former editor of Film Comment and is a professor of film and media studies at the University of Minnesota. She has a new book out called Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War. Alice, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Interesting things that you're writing about, the intersection of film and culture and politics, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's a big part of it. Yeah. This is a book that takes something we're really familiar with, right? The film, the celluloid that you might remember loading into a camera and getting back from the Photoshop along with the envelope full of pictures.
Yep.
And it looks at it through a very different lens, which is the lens of the chemical industry.
All right. That makes no sense to me. So why are we relating those? Obviously, you used to use a lot of chemicals to develop those pictures, right?
Sure.
One of Kodak's biggest products. Tell us a lot more. Go ahead and dive in.
So details. It's a book that shows how when we think of, you know, we think of film as part of culture, part of our leisure life, something that entertains us. It's something that, you know, we use to relax and that we, you know, send photos to people we know. But when we think about it in a different, through the lens of the chemical industry, we can see something very different. We see a different and in many ways more fundamental part of the history of companies like Kodak, which otherwise is a household name, right? Something that, again, we take snapshots with it. We might have made home movies with it. And it shows that they were major players in the chemical industry, which meant that they were very diversified. So they also made plastics, and they made rayon, and they made pharmaceuticals, and they made weapons, like many chemical companies. So the book focuses on the stories of two companies, Tennessee Eastman, which was Eastman Kodak's primary chemical subsidiary. It's now known as Eastman Chemical, and Kodak's main competitor, the German company Agfa. And one of the main stories it tells is of Tennessee Eastman's and Eastman Kodak's work for the Manhattan Project, separating uranium at Oak Ridge. So this is a story we don't know that much about to this point. We haven't heard that much about to this point, but it has a lot to tell us about the complex consequences of military-industrial entanglements. And again, it asks us to see film and Kodak in a new light.
A bad light?
Complicated light. No, I don't think it's a bad light. I think it's, I mean, these are, they're the company, you know, so again, this is a book that looks at the United States, but it also looks at global stories, stories in Germany and in France and elsewhere. There were many, many private companies working for the Manhattan Project. And it just shifts the focus on what kind of a company this was and what it did.
Okay. What were the connections? I know that Oak Ridge where Kodak had a facility really close to where they were doing part of the Manhattan Project, right?
So there's two cities is the subsidiary that's that is in Tennessee, not too far from Oak Ridge. But there, Kodak and Tennessee Eastman were in charge of operating the Y-12 uranium separation plant at Oak Ridge, which was one of the three largest installations at Oak Ridge.
Okay, so did those people know what they were doing? Did they know that they were part of the Manhattan Project?
As with all private companies involved in the Manhattan Project, secrecy was a huge part of the work. And so some people did, very, very few people did, but for the most part, people didn't know.
All right. And you mentioned that they were producing weapons. Chemical weapons? They were separating.
Yeah. In the case of the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge, they were separating uranium.
Okay.
So that was uranium that ended up being used in the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, just about 80 years ago.
Interesting. All right. How did they get involved in this in the first place? Did government come to them and demand their help?
Yes. The request came from the Manhattan Engineer District. It came from General Leslie R. Groves, familiar with from the film Oppenheimer, and many people will be.
Yes.
It was a request that came through not because they had any specific knowledge of the work that was to be done, but because they were extremely good at mass production. The company had been involved in mass producing the explosive RDX, which is a submarine explosive, nearby for a year or so. And before that, it was extremely good at mass producing film. It was the world's largest film manufacturer throughout the 20th century.
Okay. And when they were doing this, were they going back and forth or, you know, traveling to where'd they build the bomb? In Arizona, Nevada? Where was that located?
So the Manhattan Project had multiple sites across the country, and the bomb was assembled in, it was built in New Mexico, in Los Alamos.
Okay, Los Alamos, that's right. In the movie, it seemed like no one was ever allowed to leave there at all.
Yeah, and that's I think this isn't something the book gets into, but there were very heavy security procedures at all of these sites, so Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and elsewhere. This is part of this history, is that these were very intense, contained areas of scientific work during these years where things were changing very quickly, and there were many, many people involved on these extremely large projects.
All right. So what is the takeaway from this, or what lessons do we learn from the book?
Yeah. I mean, so there's, on the one hand, there's a thing that I mentioned about how we can think about film and photography differently, right? That there is a darker history, a more complex history below what we think of as something that is kind of a benign, happy part of our lives. These were companies that made many different things. And this is something that I think we can take into our contemporary media lives, right? We know that our smartphones and computers can't run without rare earths, without materials that have very violent histories behind them as they're extracted, as they're used. We know about cobalt, we know about lithium that are used in smartphones and electric cars. But one of the things that Tales of Militant Chemistry shows is that these histories, these present day histories, are part of a much longer story, one that stretches back to film, and that film isn't something that we can think of as part of a kind of innocent golden age, an age of Hollywood's ascendance, an age of home movies, etc. That it's also part of the chemical age, which is an age of toxic waste and forced labor and proliferating weapons. So that's one side of it. But there's another story that the book tells that's about, again, the complex consequences of corporate military entanglements. And so this is a story that begins in the early 1950s when Kodak was really one of the first entities in the United States to grasp the extent of fallout from nuclear arms testing. So testing really took off around 1950, 1951 in the United States and elsewhere. And the company made this realization because it had started to discover little spots on its film, film that hadn't been used yet, that hadn't been developed yet. And these spots were made by fallout, they determined. right? So the Atomic Energy Commission had no conception that fallout could travel that far and be that dangerous. But Kodak was the company that got them to realize that it was traveling very far and that it needed to be investigated. So, of course, there's irony in the fact that the company who had helped a company that helped shape the bomb and its history ended up finding its business, its bottom line, really threatened by the same technology, by fallout from similar bombs. But what happens next makes the story even more complicated because the Atomic Energy Commission began giving Kodak and other photographic manufacturers in the United States advance warning of weapons tests so that the company could protect its raw material supplies and protect its factories from fallout. But people living around the factories weren't getting the same warnings. So this is a kind of story about, again, what matters, right? Industry and people and the consequences about this. And I think we can see echoes of this still today.
Like what? What do we, how does it
Well, I think, you know, for instance, yeah, over the past couple of weeks, just watching the EPA rolling back policies on industrial pollution, right? It's a question of how do we say what the harms are, right? What are the harms within an industry and what are the harms to people living around those industries and working in those industries?
Right. We very rarely hear about that until it blows up.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a question of secrecy and whom secrecy serves to.
You know, Coca-Cola really benefited from World War II. It left Coca-Cola with a global distribution system. You know, the policy of every soldier should have a Coke when they get back. Did Kodak develop in a similar way? Did this help Kodak tremendously after the war? Did it position them for the dominance that they had in the 50s, 60s?
It's a great question. You know, Kodak was dominant from the beginning of the 20th century. So it was really the biggest brand in film and photography from the beginning of the industry, because the industry really started in the late 19th century. But one of the things that the war did for film was to really give a leg up to the 16 millimeter format, which you might remember from projectors, AV projectors in classrooms. Yeah. So that format is made of a substance called cellulose acetate, which is a slow burning plastic. And it's the kind of plastic that you might have in the glasses that you wear, things like that. And that kind of film really took off during World War II. It was used in military contexts, it was used in educational contexts, and then it became huge in the 1950s and 60s. So I do think there's a really important role that the war has to play in shaping cinema culture. And of course, the company and many other photographic companies played a crucial role in keeping soldiers, U.S. soldiers, connected to their families at home through snapshots, through technologies that allowed soldiers' letters to be photographed onto film. So really micro photography. So you could ship a whole bunch of letters on one reel of film instead of bags and bags of mail.
Okay. Very interesting. I just knew absolutely nothing about this. How did Kodak fail? Was it just digital photography? I think they actually developed digital photography from what I remember. At the Palo Alto Research Center, perhaps, at Park. Or was that Xerox? Maybe that was Xerox.
You know, this is actually beyond the scope of the book, so I don't know this history very well.
Yeah. But do you know anything about why Kodak failed? They're so well-positioned.
Yeah, it has to do with not grasping the sort of digital future, but there are better histories out there on that than mine, I imagine. And so, because this book really ends in the early 1960s.
Okay. What about Agfa? We know so little about them. I know that company, I've heard that name, but I don't know anything else. That's it.
Yeah, so you may be familiar with Agfa, and your listeners may be familiar with Agfa because it was part of the notorious IG Farben chemical cartel, which was very, very involved with Nazi Germany's military industrial complex. So Agfa was a smaller company than Kodak, but a larger presence in many ways in the chemical industry because it really began as a dye manufacturer and then ended up diversifying into film. Whereas with Kodak, it was a film manufacturer and ended up diversifying into other products, pharmaceuticals, plastics, et cetera. So the story that the book tells is, on one hand, one of the about these two companies in the 19-teens, the 1920s, competing for global dominance through mergers and by intellectual property questions. But during the war, it also tracks AGFA's involvement in Nazi Germany's military work, which was really can't be compared with what was going on with Kodak in the United States, because it's on a different, completely different register, because AGFA was involved with the military industrial system, the IG Farben cartel was, that was really inseparable from Nazi Germany's concentration camps, and that relied on forced labor and concentration camp prisoners. So this is a different story, very different company, very different political context, very different scale of involvement with the military. But it's one that also asks us to think about film as part of the chemical industry and to say, hey, actually, film was not, maybe not the largest product these companies made. Maybe there were chemicals that were the larger product, et cetera, but the companies end up associated more closely with these film products.
If I would Kodak, I would want people to know that we helped.
Of course. Yeah.
But I had never heard that. So how did Kodak not get that word out, or was the government preventing them from sharing this information?
No, I mean, I think it's pretty, like many companies that were involved with the Manhattan Project, of course, nobody could say anything during the war. But after that veil of secrecy lifted, Kodak and Tennessee Eastman didn't keep this secret. So it was in shareholder reports. It was in company newspapers. So there was a lot of, relief at having helped end the war, right? That was a lot of how this was discussed at that time. So I think, I think that part of this is just about how we move on in time and forget in certain histories, and how certain histories get uncovered as new urgent things come up. But it was one of the biggest companies working at Oak Ridge.
Interesting. Your Amazon listing says that this book, and I'm quoting, shows how film became a weapon. Why are we saying film is a weapon?
Well, one of the stories that the book tracks, and this is really a key part of the book, is how when we think back to the substances and the raw materials that are used to make film, we can see how these are directly linked to weapons. So film itself wasn't a weapon. I think it's a bit of a bit of a poetic license being right. Taken here. But when we think about poison gas, there's a direct relationship here insofar as poison gas, which is something that some film manufacturers in Europe also made, was made from the same organic chemicals that were used to make dyes and used to make film. And so these histories are quite direct. And when we think about Tennessee Eastman and the Manhattan Project, one of the chemical products that made Tennessee Eastman into the chemical powerhouse that it became in the 1930s was cellulose acetate, this non-flammable or less flammable plastic that I've just mentioned, which was used to make 16 millimeter film. So the company became very good at mass producing this film using the specific chemicals that it required. This led it to mass produce RDX, again, the anti-submarine explosive, which it made nearby, which used the same chemicals. And that mass production set the stage for it to be able to handle the sheer amount of work and the chemical processes that were happening at Oak Ridge at Y-12.
What about waste and unpleasant off products of the film industry? Their waste, or is that part of the story at all? Did they do a good job of cleaning up after themselves?
It is part of the story. And I think it's linked to the fallout question too, when we think about the kinds of pollution that come from industrial production. So yeah, the film manufacturing industry has always been a very dirty industry. Many of the chemicals that film factories use are toxic. And these chemicals often spilled beyond factories, or they were dumped outside factory walls. And there was great harm that came from this. And there is wonderful scholarship in film and media and the environmental social humanities that's discussed this. So I think it's pretty well known that Kodak's headquarters in Rochester, New York, was the site of a massive cleanup in 2014. And in Germany, the other factory that I focus on a great deal was known for sending toxic runoff into local waterways. And this is damage that's still being remediated today. So some of the sites where the wastewater was put are still being dealt with as sort of toxic sites.
Horrible. Horrible.
It's a complicated history, but it's also, it's an industrial history, right? It's a history of industry, and it's something that we can only think of as, you know, the images we take and the photographs we have and the movies we might watch or, you know, record of our children, that this is a history that's tied up with much larger industries.
From a film educator, were there great movies during that time?
You know, absolutely.
What are the standouts that you still study today?
Yeah, well, The Best Years of Our Lives, I mean, the classic World War II films. That's one of the ones that I often teach. I'm hard pressed to think, I'm going to have to look up in my old syllabi to find others, but World War II was a hugely important moment for the film industry all over the world. I mean, they were dealing with shortages. There were shortages in film, many of them caused by film manufacturers' work for the chemical industry and the military industries in their various countries. There were shortages in electricity to light a set. Actors and technicians were called up to the armies in their various countries, but it's still a moment that produced films that we watch and teach today. You know, one of the examples in the U.S. too is the Why We Fight series, the series of nonfiction films that were about, you know, kind of U.S. propaganda about it's the country's involvement in the war. So yeah, this is all extremely important to how we think about World War II, how we teach cinema and its history. But this is part of that history that is closely tied up with this, because the shortage, I mean, because at the same time that the companies were making were involved with producing the materials to make films, they were doing other things at the same time. So AGFA is a good example of this as well. One of the company's biggest innovations of the 30s and 40s was its color film, which was really the best on the market. Nobody had ever seen a color film work like this before. Hitler was, you know, enamored of this. It was very much part of the Nazi propaganda machine. This was a film that AGFA developed scientifically and, you know, came out of the same factories and the same kind of research and development apparatus that was working for the military in other ways. And after the war, the same color film formulas, the scientific formulas, became spoils of war. This is something the book discusses as well. As countries sent over film executives to Germany right after the war ended to try to get the intellectual property, to get the formulas for these for this extraordinary color film, and then bring it back and adapt it in their own ways.
Well, I've heard about the rocket scientist coming from Germany to Alabama. You know, that's well documented. I didn't know that there was also a dash to get film technology by Americans. I've never seen that movie.
Yeah. Yes, it was a really big deal, and they were over very, very early. So within, you know, a couple of weeks of the end of hostilities in Germany, there were executives from all sorts of American film companies, Canadian film companies, French film companies, British film companies over in Germany, really working in the factories, finding the formulas, interviewing people, taking scientists and technicians and enticing them, or in some cases forcing them to move to Western zones of Germany. And the Soviets were doing the same. So it turned into a Cold War flashpoint as well, this competition over formulas and film.
I didn't think Oppenheimer was that good of a movie, to be honest. I fell asleep.
Yeah.
Does that say a lot about me?
No. I mean, you know, to each their own. I would never judge anybody on taste. I think it's an interesting film. One of the things that I write about in the book is that, you know, so it's shot on, well, it's shown on 70 millimeter, which is the widest film format. It's just, if anybody who went to see it in the cinema would know that you had to get a special ticket and go to a special movie theater to see it on its original format of 70 millimeter. So 70 millimeter, when it's shot in the camera, is made on 65 millimeter film, which is made of cellulose acetate, which is the product that, as I've just discussed, brought Eastman Kodak and Tennessee Eastman to the Manhattan Project. So there is a kind of interesting historical loop there in the very film that it was made on.
Totally discarding the book, how is the film industry today? Are we producing masterpieces today or Marvel trash?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think there is remarkable.
No. You're the film professor. You're the expert on
yeah,
this.
I will say most of my work is historical, so I don't really focus on the present day, but I think there is wonderful work happening today. I think that not all of that work is happening from the core of what we would think of as Hollywood. A lot of that work is happening outside Hollywood, happening in more independent spaces. A lot of it is happening abroad. But I think there's a great deal of growth and creativity and how we make films and how we think about making films. So I'm optimistic, even if I think that, you know, some of the formulas are a bit tired.
What's the best movie you've seen recently?
Oh gosh. this is the worst question to ask a film scholar. I hope you can edit this out because I cannot remember.
All right. No worries. That's not.
Yeah. I actually, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a complete blank. So if you don't mind editing that out.
What about the war movies like Midway and all of those? Is there a famous or what's the best war movie? What movie do you think captures World War II the best?
World War II. Gosh. Well, I mean, The Best Years of Our Lives is really a wonderful film and thinking through what it meant to return from the war. I think it's a beautiful film. It's in terms of American films on the war. On the Russian side, Tarkovsky's Ivan's Childhood is a really wonderful World War II film. You know, in terms of World War I, there's also the French film Grand Illusion, which is a remarkable film. I would recommend everybody see it. Just beautifully shot.
All right. Quite a few ones I'm going to have to check out. I'm one of the people that whenever, you know, the genre of war movie, like Midway or those things, I have to stop and watch.
Yeah. Oh, great.
World War II war movies.
Show
us winning.
And there's a lot from many different perspectives in many different countries. And it's interesting to see, you know, what they look like alongside one another, because it was such a complicated moment in global history, not just U.S. history.
Well, I think it's also interesting, you know, they made a new version of Midway 5 or 6 years ago, and that movie was almost entirely financed by Chinese because the Chinese and the Japanese still just hate each other.
Well, I think China's involvement in Hollywood is one of the most important stories, or the entanglement between China and Hollywood is one of the most important stories in the film business today, in terms of China's importance as a market for U.S. films.
And it's interesting, talking about current events, that Atlanta, Georgia, has become a movie mecca. We're one of the top studio places in the world now, which I think is a reflection of tax policy. Am I right there?
I believe so. I don't know exactly the tax structure that works out there, but yes, many cities in and beyond North America are trying to, you know, make themselves, and successfully in the case of Atlanta, spaces that are really amenable to productions, right? Both because of tax breaks and because of professionals in the area who can work a set. So absolutely.
There used to be a Ford factory that they tore down, and it's now 30 sound stages, I think.
A whole
district of studios, and that's on the north side. And then on the south side, we have the Tyler Perry complex, He's building a million square feet of studios in South Atlanta, which is just fascinating to watch. You know, there are Hollywood tours now in Atlanta, believe it or
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, there's obviously things are very complicated in terms of California's economy and its reliance on film industry, but it's great to see shooting happening in different parts of the country. And I think your example of the Ford factory turning into studios is really interesting in terms of what powers industry and what kinds of industry take root in different parts of the country at different moments.
Yes. Alice, absolutely fascinating. I will look at all of this differently now, and I've got to go watch a war movie now. How do we find out more about you, get a copy of the book, continue to learn from you?
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
How do we learn from you? How do we get in touch? How do we find out more about you?
Yes, you can go to www.alicelovejoy.com. We can find all my social links and email address. I look forward to hearing how the book does as it gets out into the world.
I hope it sells well for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question. That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
Welcome back to School for Startups Radio. Again, thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited to introduce you to my first guest. His name is Ron Fry, and you probably know him pretty well. There's a lot of things out there that he is responsible for. First, he is the guy behind the author behind the How to Study series, which has sold more than 3 million copies. He has written 30 other books in the areas of education and careers, and he is the founder of Career Press, which is a very large, very well-known independent publisher of nonfiction books. And today we're excited to talk about his new book that just came out last month, or maybe this month, maybe a week or so ago, called 101 Great Answers to the Toughest Interview Questions. Ron, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Great to be with you, Jim.
Well, I appreciate your time and looking forward to learning from you. Tell us about the new book, 101 Great Answers to the Toughest Interview Questions.
You know what? I wrote the initial edition of this book 27 years ago, which makes me feel awfully old. And at the time, as I recall, unemployment was pretty low and it was pretty tough finding a job. And then you go through 27 years and you realize everything really is very cyclical. Every 2 or 3 or 4 years, suddenly the job market opens up and candidates can get any job they want. And then 2 or 3 or 4 years later, it's a horrible situation and there are no jobs for everyone. But, you know, whichever situation it is, whether it's a buyer's market and the employers are in charge, or it's a seller's market and the candidates have a lot of choice, you still need to be able to ace the interview. And that's why I wrote 101 Great Answers to the Toughest Interview Questions.
All right. Give me some of the questions and let me see how well I can do with my answers. How about that, Ron?
Okay. So, Jim, tell me about the biggest mistake you ever made.
Well, I know that I've made many mistakes in my career, but there are one or two that stick out. 3 or 4 jobs ago, I actually ran over my boss's foot in the parking lot. And he was really good about it. He didn't get mad at me. I don't think he held it against me. I tried to be really honorable about it and pay his bills and all of that, even though it was going to come out of his pocket in the end anyway. So that's probably my biggest mistake, Ron.
Okay, a very funny answer, but not a great answer. For the simple fact that you want to be able to admit a real mistake, preferably something from the job or previous position, but then you want to be able to pivot very positively to what you did to correct that mistake, maybe what new skill set you learned, maybe something maybe a seminar you went to, something that helped you get past that, and how you would never make that mistake again because you've learned X, Y, and Z.
All right. Very good. All right.
Let's play again. But I feel sorry for your boss.
Yes, I am too. All right. Play again. Give me another one.
Well, Jim, why don't you just tell me about yourself?
Golly, that's a very hard one. There's a lot of things I'd like you to know about me. I'm a really good self-starter. I feel like I take initiative very well. I have had lots of industry experience in this particular industry. Just, you know, your company of knife manufacturing. I've been in knife sales and knife retail for the last 3 or 4 years. And I have a really strong work ethic, and I'm excited to work here, and I think that we're a great fit.
That was pretty darn good. You started off by pausing for a second, which is fine. A lot of times, and you would know from being on radio, if we pause for 1 or 2 seconds, which is okay to kind of get our thoughts together, it seems like we're pausing for 30 seconds, but it's really not, and it's okay. The other thing you did was you didn't start off by saying, well, I was born, you know, or start talking about your kindergarten crush or your hobbies in eighth grade. Really kept it very short and sweet and to the point about your qualifications. That was a really good answer.
Awesome. All right. All right. And I'm really good with knives. So
you're good with knives. And you're good with ex-bosses who have problems with their feet.
Who was actually running from me at the time because I was throwing knives at him. I left that part of the story out. All right. Give us one more, and then we're going to move on to another topic. Give me one more question, Ron.
Have you ever been fired?
Yes, I was. And when it happened, it was one of those absolutely devastating things. I was working at Coca-Cola. And I actually put together a project that saved them $1 billion, Ron, over 10 years. And I was trying to transfer out of the Japan office and into the Atlanta office. And in the process, a discussion of my career was inevitable. And 2 or 3 people said that I had the non-Coca-Cola personality and I should go off and do something on my own. And so I left Coca-Cola. I was devastated and hurt. But, you know, in retrospect, it's the best thing that ever happened. It put me on the career path that I'm on today.
Boy, you are just acing these. What a terrific answer. Being able to start by saying, yes, I was fired, but, and then saying, but I saved my company $1 billion. I think that's an absolutely terrific answer. Again, the real key, the interviewer is going to try and trip you up. That's what they're there for, especially in human resources, because they've got 100 resumes on their desk, 200 resumes. They're not looking for why you're the right candidate. They're looking for why you're not the right candidate. So all they're seeking is a reason to eliminate you. And whenever you introduce a negative, that's a reason. So they'll introduce a negative and see how you handle it. As you and I were talking earlier, there's a famous thing called the Reagan pivot, which is whatever question you're asked, it doesn't mean you actually have to answer it. You can answer the question you wish they asked. So when President Reagan was asked about the economy and what was going on with unemployment, his answer was, thank you. I, too, support the Nicaraguan freedom fighters. And before you know it, he was off on a completely different answer. But what's interesting is nobody ever went back and said, wait a minute, that wasn't the question we asked. If your answer is good enough, it doesn't matter what the question was.
Well, that is certainly one of the things that we do on radio is we talk about what we want to talk about, you know. And a good interviewee, I was interviewing someone yesterday, Ron, and I asked them something totally irrelevant, like about Duke basketball, actually. And he came back, and before 30 seconds was gone, he had turned that into a story about his new book. And I was like, that's pretty good.
There you go.
There is the pivot. All right. So, you know, you've had a very interesting long career. You've been active in so many different spaces. I want to talk about some of the other things you're doing right now. In particular, education. I am beyond concerned with every level of the education system in the U.S. I was a instructor at a downtown university for 9 years and taught 250 undergrads and grads a semester, so I was the workhorse there. I'm beyond concerned about education in the United States. What about you, Ron?
Well, one of the things that's happening, I mean, it ties into the other topics we're talking about, is jobs are disappearing to some extent. You know, if you can hire someone in Singapore to make your sneaker for 50 cents an hour or a dollar a day or $2 a day, why in heaven's name would you ever pay someone $30 or $40 an hour to do it in the United States? So the fact that a lot of these good, well-paying factory jobs are disappearing really is inevitable because of the globalization of the world. And, you know, I don't want to get political, but when politicians say, well, we're going to bring all these manufacturing jobs back, that just economically makes no sense at all. Maybe another point is, you know, we've come to a point in the United States, I think, where a lot of people think college is mandatory. And the truth is that there are a lot of kids that really aren't ready for college, maybe just not ready right now, or simply not ready at all. And there's nothing wrong with encouraging them into vocational education. I was reading last week there are actually 5.5 million jobs that need to be filled right now in the United States, but they require some skill. There's electricians, there are nurses, there are teachers, there are plumbers, there are computer programmers. So if you can see the areas that are growing, if you can see the jobs that are always going lacking, then you should go and get the skills needed to get that particular job. Whether or not you're ready for college, whether or not you go to college, I think a college education is a wonderful thing, but I'm not sure everyone requires one in order to have a productive life.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Plumbers, welders are making $150,000 a year now. So, Ron, you've written about so many different topics. You have a book out yourself on just about everything in the business space that I can think of. How do you know so much? How do you have such prolific abilities?
Oh, stop, Jim. I'm blushing.
How are you so perfect?
I am not so perfect, and it's you know, the nice thing about starting and owning a publishing company, which I've done now for 31 years, which, of course, I started when I was 5. But the nice thing about that is you can also publish your own books. So we actually publish just about 52 books a year, one book a week, and that takes a little bit of daring do.
Well, that's one way to put it, right? How much time do you spend every day learning?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I think a surprising amount of time. I mean, I run a company. I still write some books. I coach high school sports. And, you know, you might not be learning a particular skill. I mean, at this point, I actually know how to write, hopefully. I know how to use my computer for the few things I need it to do. But, you know, you're always learning about people. You're always learning about culture and the arts and new things that are happening. And again, we were talking about students and whether they need to go to college or go to vocational school or whatever. But one of the things I would strongly advise anybody is read a daily newspaper. I mean, okay, you can do it on your phone. I do. You can do it on your computer, but being involved in what's going on in the world and knowing what's going on in the world, even if you're only interested from a job standpoint, you're going to start seeing where the developments are happening, where the jobs are opening up, what you need to prepare yourself for.
Well, that is great advice, and I certainly take that to heart. I try to spend at least 5 minutes a day looking at the news and stuff that I could care less about. I don't follow sports at all, Ron. I just don't pay attention. But I do look the next day to see who won the Super Bowl so that I can pretend to know, right?
Tell us more about Career Press, the company that you started when you were five. You said 31 years now. What type of books do you look for there? What are your criteria? Right, I've been on the show here talking that all of my listeners should write a book and try to get it published because it really does help your career. What are your thoughts on the books you are looking to publish today?
Oh, boy, now you're going to get me in trouble. I'm going to get 8,000 manuscripts.
Anything you say, you're going to get flooded with. Well, talk in generality.
We publish a wide variety of nonfiction books. I try to avoid anything that's sort of faddish. I don't do celebrity books or a lot of diet books or, what's the latest healthcare thing that you should do to get rid of your pimples or something like that. For the most part, what Career Press publishes are very practical books, how to get a job, how to do better at work, how to be a good boss, how to be a good employee, how to eat better. One of the other series that I've written that I'm really most proud of is a series called Ron Fry's How to Study Program. And How to Study itself, which is the main book, was actually just reissued about 4 or 5 weeks ago. And that is very specifically for junior high, middle school, high school, and college students, or for that matter, adults going back to school, who need help, whether it's taking tests, writing a better paper, getting organized, being on top of their time management, taking better notes, doing better in class. So that kind of book that's hopefully going to help somebody do better in their life, do better in their career, is the kind of book that Career Press publishes.
And what is the perfect proposal look like? So one that makes you just pick up the phone and call the guy who wrote it right then. What does that kind of proposal look like?
Standard proposal is a good table of contents, at least one chapter, preferably two or three, and then an analysis of the market and why that person thinks the book is going to sell. And especially in this environment, and hopefully we all know what's been going on with book publishing and how difficult it's become, what that author is capable of doing themselves. What kind of a platform do they have? What kind of speaking do they do? Are they a teacher? Are they a professional speaker? The more the author is capable of promoting that book and that idea. There are 200,000 or 300,000 books published every year. Trying to stand out from the pack is extremely difficult. A good author shows you how they're going to be capable of doing that. We probably get in the neighborhood of 30 to 50 manuscripts or proposals a week.
But you're going to send me on a big book tour. You're going to send me to 15 different cities and arrange speaking gigs for me, Mr. Publisher. I mean, that's what I've always heard.
You know what? 15 or 20 years ago, the biggest books got 15 city book tours. The top celebrities and authors still sometimes do from the largest publishers. But for the most part, that kind of very expensive travel around the United States, or for that matter, internationally, is out the window. And in terms of speaking engagements and all that, that's usually something that the author winds up being responsible for themselves.
But you're going to get me in CNN first, right? I mean, the publisher, are going to do tons of PR work for me and get me all over New York Times, right?
Well, getting on CNN is tough. I was actually on CNN very early in my career, and I was on for 25 minutes, which is a lifetime television. And I've done, Good Morning America and Today.
But they never invited you back, Ron?
I was back a couple of times.
Okay,
but,
I'm sorry.
It's a tough gig. And more and more publicity is being done via Twitter, via Facebook, via social media. So again, being familiar with technology, being able to get your message out in whatever content. I mean, for example, 101 Great Answers to the Toughest Interview Questions, which just came out, it's in paperback. It's available for download. It's in an ebook. It's an audio book. So the idea is whatever way you want to learn, whatever way you're comfortable, whether it's sitting in an easy chair and actually reading a good old paper book, which I kind of like, whether you're reading it on your smartphone or whether you're listening to it while you're driving to work. All of that is possible, and I think the vast majority of new books coming out from major publishers are trying to spread that content in as many forms as possible.
Jeff Bezos, hero or villain?
Well, you know, in book publishing and certainly in other aspects of life, there have always been the titans. You know, for a while it was Ma Bell, and Ma Bell owned everything. And then before you knew it, there were a whole bunch of regional telephone companies because they forced Ma Bell to split up. In book publishing, there was a point at which Barnes & Noble was the big gorilla in the room, and whatever Barnes & Noble said, you did. Today, Amazon is taking a greater and greater share, not just of printed books, but even of certainly of e-books with Kindle, and even of audiobooks because they own Brilliance Audio, among other companies. So there's always somebody who's the big gorilla in the room, and you just have to work with them. And it can be good or bad depending on your situation. For me, Amazon is good. I do remember back about 30 years ago being at a trade show and seeing Jeff Bezos and his one little booth with this crazy company called Amazon at the book show, and everyone kind of ignored him. Well, they're not ignoring him anymore.
That is very true. But you hear about the kerfuffles that go on from time to time, publishers getting locked out and things like that. Are you making a fair, decent percent of an Amazon sale as a publisher?
Well, I'm still in business, so if I hadn't figured out a way to make a profit on certainly most books, I wouldn't be in business. I've managed. It's become certainly more and more challenging since the Great Recession, but I think that if you're committed, if you're passionate, if you pick the right books, if you promote them right, if you show people that this is a book that will actually help them, then I think you can have a successful writing career and a successful publishing career.
Do you pick authors or titles or topic, right? Are you, if you are someone with a huge platform, someone that you really are impressed with and want to work with, comes to you, will you help them shape a good topic, a good subject? Or is subject rules and that's where you really want to go in? What excites you more?
Well, probably 85 to 90% of the books that we wind up publishing have some sort of literary agent attached. So to a great extent, that agent has already probably polished the proposal, really helped that author home in on the right topic, gotten them to understand what they need to do to support that book. So a lot of the work has been done for us in that regard. But we wind up editing every book, some more so than others. Some books are basically just copy edited and you fix the commas and you fix the semicolon. And other books, when they're first submitted, we may very well say, you know, we need to move this chapter around and change that, and maybe you need to add 10,000 words on a completely different topic. So the publisher still has to really help the author, especially a first-time author, concentrate on and focus their book so that it's the most helpful to the most people.
Ron, I really appreciate you being with us today. Tell people where they can get a copy of your latest book, 101 Great Answers to the Toughest Interview Questions, where they can learn more about you, follow you on social media, and hang out at your house.
As I said, it's available in print, ebook, digital download, audiobooks. You can go wherever books are sold, either online or brick-and-mortar stores, from Barnes & Noble to your favorite local bookstore.
Fantastic. Ron, thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope you'll come back soon and introduce some of your authors to us.
Terrific, Jim. Thank you so much.
We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.